If we could make our way back into the hall, and prepare for the final revelatory session that will once and for all solve all of your questions. Or not. So we're about to begin the final session. 6:30 is finished, yeah? 6:30. Yeah, so this one from 4:30 to 6:30. And we're going to be looking at some of the remaining suttas that were on the reading list. Going over again some of these different aspects of karma. And hopefully revealing some of the subtleties in the teaching of karma, which we also find in the suttas. So, do you want to do this one, or do you want me to start with? Okay, so this is Majjhima Nikaya number 60, the Apandaka Sutta. And here is this excerpt from it. And for many of these suttas, we've just chosen passages because the suttas themselves are quite long and repetitive. So, now, householders, of those recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this, there is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. No fruit or result of good and bad actions, no this world, no other world, no mother, no father, no beings who are reborn spontaneously, no good and virtuous Brahmins and recluses and Brahmins in the world who have themselves realized by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. It is to be expected that they will avoid these three wholesome states, namely good bodily conduct, good verbal conduct, and good mental conduct. And they will undertake and practice these three unwholesome states, namely bodily misconduct, verbal misconduct, and mental misconduct. Why is that? Because these good recluses and Brahmins do not see in unwholesome states the danger, degradation, and defilement, nor do they see in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation and the aspect of cleansing. I might just remark here that I really dislike the use of the word states here. I think it's completely inappropriate. And it's translating, obviously, Dhamma. Perhaps principles would be better in this particular case. Qualities, yeah, anything, please. How can you undertake and practice an unwholesome state? It doesn't make sense. Anyway, sorry. Just my complaining. Sorry? Yeah, but that's not what it means. Apart from anything else, it's not merely wrong. It's actively misleading, right? You can have a state of mind, but a state of mind being like a thing like the overall condition that your mind is in, right? So that's an idiomatic phrase, but that actually is more like the word citta in Pali. Right? Citta is more like a state of mind. Yeah. Whereas this is Dhamma, which is something quite different, actually. Yeah, so... Sorry? The Pali word is Dhamma, Akusala Dhamma. Yeah. Sorry, Jake, yeah. Ah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
There's, you know, doubt as to meaning of words.
Yeah.
So how much more difficult it will be in Pali. I'm not undermining the great difficulty a translator has in translating this. But if we feel that it cannot be improved, I think that's the wrong way. We should always look to improve the translations.
Mm.
So a course like this is an opportunity for you, the Sangha members, to hear the difficulties that, you know, we have in trying to understand the suttas.
Okay, thanks for that, Jake. Yes. States. Go on. One second. Isn't it?
Thank you. This extract here is from Sutta Central.
Bodhi's translation? Yeah.
It's
It's from Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation here. Sorry.
It's okay. So this is an extract from Sutta Central, correct?
It's from Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, which we have on
Sutta Central. Yes, so I have the same issue in French. I got Sutta that we are going to put in Sutta Central that I'm not happy with some translation. And so here, you are not going to correct the English, or are you going to correct the English?
Ah, am I going to correct the English? Well, this translation is by Bhikkhu Bodhi, so I would be far too reluctant to even to do anything like that. Now, well, apart from anything else, these translations are under a restrictive license, so it's illegal to make any alterations to them. Okay, so yeah, that's that. I certainly think it's a good idea to develop. And evolve translations is one of the reasons why I think it's much better that all Buddhist texts, and especially translations of Buddhist texts, should be released into the public domain, so that they can evolve and change and develop and so on. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So for me, it's a bit misleading because Sutta Central is a repository for us who want to learn, as our friend was saying. Are not capable of learning from the Pali directly.
Yes. Yeah.
So we want to learn the Dhamma by reading the suttas. And if we are reading sutta which obviously we are not correct, then it's a problem.
Well, in this case, it's not really a matter of being incorrect. It's just a matter of like a preference as to a choice of translations. On the whole, Bhikkhu Bodhi's translations are obviously the kind of the gold standard in terms of what's been done. I think Venerable Bodhi himself would be the first to say that, there are a lot of choices are subjective and there's a lot of room for improvement. His own style has evolved over the years, and this was the first major collection that he translated. Venerable Brahmali would know more about this because you were involved very closely with Venerable Bodhi in especially both the Sanyutta and Anguttara translations. So you might have something to say about that?
I just don't think that there is such a thing as a final translation or a correct...
Is that coming out?
Working? Yeah? Yeah.
Yes.
And there is no such thing as an absolutely correct translation or an absolutely wrong translation. There's always degrees. You can look at the same text from different angles. So one day one translation is right, the next day the other translation is right. So the best thing to do is not to try to change the text and always kind of go back and forth. The best thing to do is just to read the suttas and then to discuss the content. And then once you discuss the content, you start to get an understanding of what's going on. I think that is the kind of the purpose of the things like the sutta classes or even this course here, to try to understand what is going on at a deeper level. And then hopefully, you can get away from these things. You really, the only way is to learn the Pali. That's really the only way to kind of go beyond translations, right? And this is the advantage. Ajahn Sajjata knows Pali very well. I know it quite well. Ajahn Brahm knows it well. Bhikkhu Bodhi obviously knows it well. So there is, and that is the kind of the advantage of being a monk. You have time to get into this kind of thing, which is great. And you can, I think that's really the only way. You have to actually discuss these things, I think, is the path. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ajahn, it looks like Bhikkhu Bodhi is using the term state not in the terms of just a mental state, but like he's got the state of a state of deprivation there. So the overall state that you're in, what condition of life you're in, is also your state, is it not?
Yes. So that's the problem, is that that's actually what state means, right? Is an overall condition of something, like you say, buildings in a state of disrepair or something like that. But of course, he's using the word state here in a state of deprivation is actually a completely different word, Pali word, than the previous word that's translated as state. Okay, so the word up here, unwholesome states is dhammas, and here is just in what is it, state of deprivation, apaya or something like that, and so it's it doesn't actually use the word dhamma in that context. It's a completely different word. Yeah. Two completely different words in Pali, yeah. And the word state means two completely different kinds of things, yeah. The use of the word state here is actually influenced by Abhidhamma the idea that each mind state or each citta is kind of one thing, and so you have this idea of Dhamma. But it's just, to me, it's wrong on many levels, not least of which is because, the word state is obviously static, Whereas the whole point about Dhamma is it's a process and it's evolving and it's changing. Yeah? So
we also have that not to despise any being in any state. Is that whatever state of...
That would be another one.
Station.
What's that one? Yeah, I know, but I'm trying to think what the Pali is. Anyway, that would be another word there, yeah. Yeah, so it is important not to overread our translations, right? You sort of read too much into them because they are, you know, even the Venerable Bodhi's translation is very precise, but still, language is a slippery thing, and you can never be completely consistent and unambiguous with it. Yeah. Yep. So I hope it hasn't left you in a state of confusion. Well, we're living here in WA, which is, aren't we the state of excitement? Sorry? Uh-huh. That's right, yeah, we're in a Dhamma of confusion, yeah. Okay, so, about this, a wise man considers us. If there is no other world, then on the dissolution of the body, this good person will have made himself safe enough. Okay? But if there is another world, then on the dissolution of the body after death, he will reappear in a state of deprivation in an unhappy destination in perdition, even in hell. Now, whether or not the word of those good recluses and Brahmins is true, let me assume that there is no other world. Still, this person is here and now censured by the wise as an immoral person, one of wrong view who holds the doctrine of nihilism. But on the other hand, if there is another world, then this good person has made an unlucky throw on both counts. Since he's censured by the wise here and now, and since on the dissolution of the body after death, he will reappear in a state of deprivation, unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. He has wrongly accepted and undertaken this incontrovertible teaching in such a way that it extends only to one side and excludes the wholesome alternative. So this is a very nice kind of argument that the Buddha's giving here. So he's giving a way of reflecting about the Dhamma and a way of showing that the principles of Dhamma that we're upholding and that we're practicing, they don't depend on these kind of views about karma and rebirth and so on. In other words, that the Buddha isn't hanging morality off rebirth. Right? This is a very important thing to understand, right? So the Buddha doesn't say that, you know, you can only live a moral life if you believe in rebirth, okay? And this is sometimes what people in religious spheres seem to be teaching. And clearly the Buddha is quite obviously saying that there is a perfectly good basis for living a moral life whether or not you believe in rebirth, okay? This is the point of this. And, of course, that's something which is objectively, obviously true. There are plenty of people who don't believe in rebirth or are agnostic about it and who live very good lives and who see good reasons for living moral lives regardless of their belief in another world. And this is actually, I think, a big problem with many religious teachings. And I've heard this taught so many times, and people will say from a religious point of view, you know, oh, we're living in this secularized age and people are so immoral and things like that. But in fact, all of the studies that have been done on this, and there's a large meta-study done a couple of years ago on this, show that consistently people in less religious regions of the world are more moral than people in more religious regions of the world. Okay, and they did this meta-study, and it was mainly based in Europe and America, so mostly in the Christian areas, and they compared the more religious areas like, say, Spain, Greece, or like the south of America or something like this, with the more secularized areas like the Nordic countries or the east coast of America or something like that, where people are less religious. And they consistently, and they use the standard of all of those things which religious people regard as being moral issues, right? So like things like teen pregnancy, drug use, abortion rates, and so on and so forth. And they consistently found that in the more religious the region was, the more abortions they had, the more teen sex they had, the more drug use there was, the more prostitution there was, all of these things, yeah? And so that's a big challenge for this whole idea of that belief in an afterlife is going to determine moral action here and now. And of course that's the facts of it, that's the statistics. The reason for those statistics is a bit harder to understand, right? Why that's the case. One possibility is that the religious areas tend to teach by thou shalt, right? So it's all about do this, don't do that. You know, if you're, you know, if you do this, and you're, you know, you go to hell or something like that. Whereas in the more secularized areas, it tends to be about education, right? It's about informing people. Well, if you do this, these are the consequences. If you do that, those are the consequences. So people are better informed. I mean, another possible reason, it's probably a relevant one, is that the religious areas tend to be poorer than the non-religious areas. So that probably also has some impact, and obviously related to the education issue as well. So, I mean, the ramifications of it are complex, but the basic idea, I think, is straightforward, that we can't say that, you know, it's necessary to believe in rebirth in order to live a moral life, okay? And that the understanding of karma and so on works whether or not you believe in rebirth. And so this kind of argument is known, was used, a form of this was used in Western philosophy, is also, we find similar structured arguments in the Death of Socrates, for example. Socrates himself uses a similar kind of argument as he's trying to soothe the grieving of his followers and friends and relatives when he was dying, because of course he had to take the hemlock and die after he'd been condemned for corrupting the youth in Athens. And because Socrates was, you know, he was a you know, quite a character, and usually on a deathbed, it's, you know, it's the relative's role to sort of, you know, they tell the dying person, you know, to be peaceful and not worry about things and so on. But in his deathbed, he was the one who was counseling all of the people who came to see him, right? Much as the Buddha did. And his argument was very much like this. He said, well, look, if there is another world, I don't know whether there's a rebirth, but if there is another world, then all I can know is that I've lived a good life in this one, and that, you know, I haven't done anything to be ashamed of. And so, you know, surely the next world must be a good place. And if there is no other world, then I'm not going to be around to experience it anyway, so who cares? And so, you know, you hear the same kind of argument. Another version of that's also found in Western philosophy, known as Pascal's Wager. And basically, you know, that one's a bit more kind of dubious logically, but basically the idea is that whether God exists or not, it's prudent to believe in God. Okay, because if God doesn't exist and you believe in God, oh well, it doesn't matter too much, right? But if God does exist and you don't believe in Him, right, then the consequences are very serious, right? So you're better off to believe in Him, even if the problem, of course, is that you can't actually make yourself believe in something. But anyway, so these kinds of arguments you do find in Western philosophy as well. And so this, I think, is a nice way of thinking about it, and that to remember that the Buddhist ideas and teachings on these things don't depend on a particular set of beliefs, right? Because people in the world obviously do have these different beliefs. And so you know, in the Buddhist perspective, obviously, in many, many cases, as we've seen, there is a close connection between these teachings on karma and rebirth, and there's no doubt they are closely connected, and there is, you know, a lot to be said about that relationship. So we don't want to sort of separate them by any means, but you do want to acknowledge that for people who, you know, maybe don't believe in rebirth or something like that, that still they can understand that these principles of karma can be observed here in this very life. Any comments on that, or any questions on that one, Apandika Sutta? No? Oh, yeah.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Hello.
This sutta doesn't seem to cover the case. I mean, I found it's quite a convoluted sutta. The case of someone who doesn't believe in rebirth or of karma, but who does lead a good life.
Uh-huh.
So...
Okay, because there's, right, because we only looked at one case here, and
yes,
there's a bunch of cases and sort of, yeah.
And I did not discern a case.
Basically,
it says you if you that? Don't believe in rebirth, then
yeah.
You've got wrong view and you're really bad.
Yeah.
Which I found difficult to deal with.
Because there's a connection between not believing in rebirth and having wrong view. Yeah, so.
Yeah, but basically it says if you don't believe in rebirth, then you will do bad things because there's no consequences of the bad things, which, let me see. Put very simply, I haven't used the words of the Buddha there.
I think the point is that the Buddha is also presenting his own teaching, right? So he's saying that there actually is another world, and for that reason, it is right of you to say that there is another world. But he says, even if you don't think there is another world, still it is a good thing to live a moral life, to live a good life. So even if you don't, still is the case. Then he says, but actually, there is one. So he's also presenting the Dhamma at the same time. I think that's all it is, actually.
Anyway, I'll keep reading it.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. I think the confusion, at least for me, on that comes around by the phrase that if someone has wrong view, they'll go to a state of deprivation.
Yeah.
But we all have wrong view until we're stream enters to a degree, right?
Oh, okay,
I mean, even if you've lived a very, very moral life, just by not yet having right view, could that really be enough to send you to a lower state?
Yeah, I think the suttas are sometimes they sometimes present things by way of sort of presenting the kind of extremes points of view, and so wrong view is I'm not sure if it's quite right to say we all have kind of wrong view until you're a stream enter. I mean, a stream enter is like perfected their right view, but you know what wrong view means in that case is a really kind of you know, it's basically a kind of a settled view that there's no such thing as good and bad, you know. And I think this is something that the Buddha regarded as being very, very basic, you know, that belief that there is good and evil is kind of, if you haven't got that, then, you know, you haven't, there's not much you can do.
Idea that there's no rebirth rather than remaining open.
Exactly, yeah, that's another point, yeah. So it's definitely talking about someone who has like this kind of dogmatic view, definitely is not talking about someone who's agnostic about it or, you know, skeptical about it or something like that. It's a very different thing, yeah.
And another aspect of that is if you read the, you know, the three higher knowledges, the, you know, the divine eye and the recollection of past lives, in there the Buddha specifically says that it is when you have a wrong, you know, peak. He sees beings going to different destinations, and you see the beings going to the bad destination is because they have wrong view, and they take those views into account in their actions. So they act in accordance with those wrong views. There's nothing bad, so they do all kind of evil stuff, right? And that is when wrong view has a really bad consequences.
In the sense that it leads to wrong action.
Yes.
Ananda.
Thank you. Just, Ajahn, just on this wrong view, could you please clarify that in the Sammaditti Sutta, it mentions that, Venerable Sariputta Sutta, that the right view can be understood in a number of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And the very first one is that what you put up, the 10 kusala actions. So we can, even though I'm saying I can't speak for the others, even though I'm not a stream enterer, but
everybody else is, I think.
Everybody else is, so that is why I didn't speak for them. So, if I understand that, at least the very first part of the Sammaditti Sutta, so that gives me some idea of right view, isn't it?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So I think.
Yeah, right view is always. I mean, the basic definition of right view is always essentially in terms of karma and rebirth. Yeah.
Karma and rebirth.
Yeah.
And the very first part of that sutta is about. It's the number 9, Majjhima Nikaya. So I remember that I've been reading that number of times.
Yes.
And it's the. It then we come to the right view. In fact, you referred it number of times today.
Yep.
That so that I think is the right view, and I'm happy that I have that. Thank you for
very good. And if anyone's interested, just to plug, I did a whole series of talks last year and discussions on the Sammaditti Sutta under the word the name Dhamma Threads. It was on the I'm not sure if they broadcast it yet, but it was on the Sri Lankan the Buddhist channel. And so we'll be putting it on YouTube sometime. So yeah, there you go. That's just a bit of publicity. Okay, moving along. Other questions? Anyone? No? Yes? No? Okay, good. Next one, Siha. Do you want to do Siha? No, we're not breaking.
Yeah, not breaking.
Okay. No, we're just plowing on through.
Okay, really? Yeah. Okay. See, okay. Okay, you're the boss. I'll just, you can decide. Oops. Okay, so this is just a short little sutta, and what we're talking about now is basically the attitude to have towards karma and rebirth. How do we deal with this? How do we think about this? And the previous one was that it is good to live a moral life regardless of whether you believe it or not. So morality is always useful. The next one here is about faith and confidence. So let's see what he has to say. So what do you think, Siha? Siha was a general at the time of the Buddha. So presumably somebody with kind of a very stern and probably kind of powerful mind. And he was one of the big disciples of the Buddha in Vaisali. And so this is what the Buddha speaking to him. But the breakup of the body after death, which person would be reborn in a good destination in a heavenly world? The one without faith or without confidence, who is miserly, mean, and abusive? Or the one endowed with confidence, a munificent giver who delights in charity? How, Bhante, could the person without confidence, who is miserly, mean, and abusive, be reborn in a good destination in a heavenly world with the breakup of the body after death? It is a person endowed with confidence, a munificent giver who delights in charity, who would be reborn in a good destination in a heavenly world with the breakup of the body after death. Right? But when the Blessed One tells me, Siha, with the breakup of the body after death, a donor, a munificent giver, is reborn in a good destination in the heavenly world, I do not know this, and here I go by confidence in the Blessed One. So it is, Siha. So it is, with the breakup of the body after death, a donor, a munificent giver, is reborn in a good destination in a heavenly world. So the point with this sutta is simply to show that there is a time for confidence, there is a time for faith in the Buddhist teachings. Sometimes when you hear about Buddhism, it's very, you know, the contemporary favorite sutta around the world, and I think still is one of the favorite ones, is the Kalama Sutta, where you're supposed to be, you know, you're supposed to have, there's no need for any confidence or faith. All you have to do is inquire and ask yourself whether what you experience, your experience actually matches with the Buddha's teachings or not. And if your experience matches with the teaching, then you accept it. If it doesn't, then you can reject it. But of course, the people often forget the context of the Kalama Sutta. The Kalama Sutta is given to a group of people who are not Buddhist, who are confused about religious teachings, who have no idea about the Buddhist teachings at all. They are novices as far as religion is concerned. And of course, for people like that, if you come into something from scratch, you need to analyze, you need to compare the different teachings, and you need to, you know, to get some starting point for having any faith and confidence in the first place. But for somebody who already is kind of leaning in the way, let's say, of Buddhism, and already, you know, has seen that many of the Buddhist teachings actually make sense, and they're already kind of leaning towards confidence in the Buddhism, of course, then there comes a point when you say, well, if the Buddha said this, and I think it is very obvious that the Buddha taught rebirth in a sutta, something you see everywhere. Well, if the Buddha said that, then it is only reasonable that you place some degree of confidence in those teachings as a consequence of that initial acceptance of Buddhism. And this is what is happening here. So the Siha, who was a very strong disciple of the Buddha, he acknowledges that. Actually, I don't know, but I'm very happy to go by confidence here in the Buddha. And this is an important thing, right? This is something we should always kind of distinguish between what is knowledge and what is faith. And if you do that, if you distinguish between knowledge and faith, it means that you're a bit more humble about your opinions. You know, so if you argue with somebody about whether there's a rebirth or not, well, actually, I don't know. But, you know, this is my confidence because I'm a Buddhist and I think the Buddha knew what he was talking about. And that is then the right attitude in this sort of situation.
I think one thing also about this sutta that's a bit skipped over because we've elided some sections, but the Buddha gives a number of different benefits of giving, and see how then responds to each one of those benefits by saying, yes, I can. I know this is true because I'm generous and I can observe this in my own life. And he says, you know, when you're generous, that you're confident among the in the assemblies, and you go in there and people know that you're a generous person, or that you feel happy because you've given and it gives you gladness of heart and so on. And so see, he lists each of those and says, I'm a generous person, and when I give, I experience that benefit, so I know that each one of those is true. And then finally he comes to the last one and he says, oh, actually, well, this one I can't see for myself, but I'll take this under faith or under confidence. So again, it's the idea that it's not blind confidence, but it's an inference, right? He's inferring it. He's already tested this whole kind of range of things, and then the last one, okay, I don't know that one yet. Maybe at some time he will, but at the moment he doesn't know that one, so he'll take that one under faith. Yeah.
And this is actually one of the, I think, important distinctions here between whether you should translate sadda as faith or confidence, just to take up Beck's suggestion there to actually discuss what these terms actually mean. And the idea, the word sadda in Buddhism has much more to do with what we understand as confidence in English than the word faith, which has a very strong Christian allusions, the idea of blind faith, of accepting things because it is irrational or this kind of stuff.
Right.
Whereas in Buddhism, actually you place confidence because you have already seen that there is some truth to this, because you already see that it works to some extent. It makes sense to some extent. That's when you place a confidence.
Yeah.
So it's more of a rational process than just a purely irrational type of faith.
Yeah, I'm sort of beginning to more wonder whether we should even be using the word faith in the context of early Buddhism. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of faith is lovely, you know, the idea of that sense of sort of emotional commitment to something, but it's just been sort of turned into a word that means it's almost better to have the more that reality disagrees with your faith, the better it is, you know.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Well, but there's so many words like that, so many words which are loaded with historical. Because of historical usage and particularly Christian usage, and that is also we're like evil. That word evil is often used to translate Pali words.
Yeah.
It's not I don't think it's a very good word to translate the Pali at all, because of the connotations. Evil, faith, and there's a whole host of other words which are often used, and I think perhaps unfortunately so.
Yeah, the word evil is evil. Okay. Yes.
This question, I apologize because it's not about karma and rebirth, but there was something that troubled me or puzzled me in this sutta, where it says that arahants first show compassion to the person without faith who is miserly, mean and abusive. That it seemed to me that is at odds with how compassion is described in other suttas, in how the Brahma Viharas are described, where you dwell compassionate to everybody, it's boundless, immeasurable, etc., etc.
Sorry, but is this also in the Upanishad?
I know what you're referring to, Venerable. Yeah, this is something you see, I think, in a few places in the suttas, and I think the idea there is just one of gratitude, right? If somebody is supportive, if somebody is already there for you, somebody has shown that they have a certain understanding of the Buddhist teaching, that's what you show about being generous, by supporting the Sangha. But somebody else who doesn't understand that, you know that they have more potential. You have a sense of gratitude towards them. I think it's actually quite natural. And for me, it makes sense that as an arahant, you would actually return that favor first before you went to somebody who didn't, who was not supportive in the same way.
I can see that. I think that would be the natural tendency of people, somebody who's supporting them, is that they would have very positive emotions towards them. But when it comes to compassion, I mean, there's actually, I can remember, I was listening to a sutta class from the sutta retreat,
okay.
Where you're talking about eliminating, I guess it was, negative feelings, negative emotions to people, negative thoughts. And one of the things, if you've had somebody who's difficult, you always try to see the positive in them, and so that somebody who's mean and miserly and awful, I would have thought that an arahant would have no, just basically no preferences, no judging of that.
Well, I think
particularly towards somebody who has no other redeeming features, that compassion is all that you can do.
I think compassion is probably, I think you're probably right, they probably would have compassion with them. But I think probably the distinction here is whether you're talking about compassion as a mental state or compassion in action.
I see.
And I understand this as more compassion in action. If you have to choose, usually there probably isn't that much of a choice anyway. You probably do whatever happens, whatever is required at the time. But if you have to choose, you probably would support somebody first who is supporting you.
Thank you.
Thank you. The last paragraph here is talking about being a donor, a beneficent giver. And as a result of that, you are reborn in a heavenly world. What's the idea of going into a Deva world, basically? Heavenly world is a world of the Deva. While, in fact, you're supposed to work into liberation of suffering by going through the four stages, reaching Arahat. So, what's really the idea of going into a Deva world here?
Remember that this is one of the things, if you read Venerable Bodhi's translation, in the Buddha's words, he talks about the different kind of benefits of the Buddha's teachings. And the Buddha's teachings is, of course, in the final sense, it is about making an end of samsara, in the final sense. But the point is that the Buddha's teaching is very broad, and it takes into account also the other types of happiness in this world. So people have different aspirations, different interests, different understandings, different levels of abilities, or whatever you might want to call it. Or for some people, will incline that way. What they would like is a good rebirth. Okay, at least I will help you that far. I will give you, this is the way to rebirth. So the Buddha, instead of just having, he has a teaching which kind of helps you across the board in a sense. And then what may happen is that as you kind of progress towards a good rebirth, you think, wait a minute, is this the right way? Maybe I need to take this deeper, right? This is often what happens. And then you take it one step deeper. And then your aspiration might evolve, so to speak, to a deeper level, and perhaps then to making an end of samsara altogether. So this is what I think one of the nice things about the Buddha. It tells you how to be happy here and now, right? It tells you how to be happy in a future life. It tells you how to reach liberation. And what is so good about it is all of these overlap. So if you live a life which truly makes you happy here and now, it's also going to help you towards liberation. That's such a positive message, right? It's not one or the other. You don't have to torture yourself here and now, and then perhaps you get liberation afterwards. No. If by being happy here and now that you get liberation afterwards, you can't really lose, right? This is the great thing about this. It's not about, you go torturing yourself and all those kind of things, which is the case in a certain religion, and then you go to a bad destination afterwards. That's pretty bad news. That's a lose-lose situation. So it's more of a win-win thing. But the other thing here, which I perhaps needs a little bit of comment as well, and perhaps we're being a little bit too sidetracked now, but is that this idea that if you are a giver, you get reborn in a heavenly world. And the point here really is that, of course, a person who is a very generous giver will also tend to be a person who is moral. This doesn't mean that you are utterly immoral, but you are very generous. Those things will tend to go together. So it's kind of understood here that you're also living a moral life at the same time.
Okay, so maybe we do a brief meditation before continuing on. Okay, so let's move along to the next sutta. MN 12, which is... Okay. Right. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so the next one is Majjhima 12, the Mahasiyanada Sutta. The Greater Discourse on the Lion's Roar. And again, just a few excerpts from it, and this one is giving some similes to show what the whole kind of rebirth thing is all about. We've talked about some of the different realms of rebirth, but what are they like? So, first example, this person so behaves and conducts himself that on the dissolution of the body he will reappear in the animal realm. Suppose there was a cesspit deeper than a man's height, full of filth, and then a man scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched and thirsty, came by a path going in one way only and directed to that same cesspit. Then a man with good sight on seeing him would say that this man is so behaving that he will come to this same cesspit, and later on he sees that he has fallen into that cesspit and is experiencing painful, racking, piercing feelings. And so this is what you can see when you see somebody who's living their life the wrong way, making lots of bad karma, and you know that they're going to go to that painful place. So the second one, the person who so lives that when they die, they'll reappear in the realm of ghosts, the hungry ghost realm. Suppose there was a tree growing on uneven ground with scanty foliage casting a dappled shadow, and then a man scorched, this is like it was set in Australia, wasn't it? A man scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched and thirsty, came by a path going in one way only and directed to that same tree. And then a man seeing him would know that he's coming to that tree, and then later on he sees that he's sitting or lying in the shade of the tree experiencing much painful feeling. In the next case, someone who lives in such a way that they're going to get reborn among human beings. Suppose there were a tree growing on even ground with thick foliage casting a deep shade, and then a man who was scorched and exhausted by the hot weather came in a path that went to that tree. And then a man with good sight seeing him would know that he would come to that tree, and that he was sitting or lying in the shade of the tree experiencing much pleasant feeling. And yet another case of somebody who's taken a path leading to the heavenly world. Suppose there was a mansion and it had an upper chamber plastered within and without, shut off, secured by bars with shuttered windows, and in it there was a couch spread with rugs, blankets and sheets with a deerskin coverlet and a canopy, as well as crimson pillows for both the head and the feet. Sounds quite nice, doesn't it? And then a man, scorched and exhausted by the hot weather, came on a path that would lead to that mansion. So he would know that somebody would go to that. And afterwards he saw that man sitting or lying in the upper chamber in the mansion, experiencing exclusively pleasant feelings. So here's kind of these different similes to sort of try to convey something about the experience, the subjective experience of those different realms. And of course, one of the issues, and I think is a genuine problem within Buddhism, is to what extent these realms are kind of objectively existing things, and to what extent that they are subjective things. And of course, one of the points from a point of view of Buddhist philosophy is that the way that we experience even the world here and now is, of course, largely determined by our own subjective points of view and perspectives and interpretation, right? And so that's the case even as we're sitting here. Surely it's also going to be the case in any state of rebirth. There's always a kind of a tendency, I think, in the way that we think about things to either reduce it to being either purely subjective, it's just a psychological state, it's a projection of your mind or something, or else to think of things as being purely objective, right? That it just is really, truly, woolly exists out there in the world. Whereas the reality that we experience is neither completely subjective nor completely objective. The reality we experience is the relationship between those two things, and that's what we experience in every moment of our consciousness. As Chakuncha Paticha Rupecha Upajati Chaku Vinyanang Tianang Sankati Paso, it's a basic description of the structure of experience that the Buddha talked about, dependent on the eye and forms. There arises eye consciousness, and the coming together of the three is contact. Contact is a condition for feeling, feeling is a condition for craving, and so on. And that's how our experience is, right? It's not just subjective and it's not just objective, right? It's the relationship between those two things. That's what the contact is. That's the spark, right? That's the pasa, stimulus that kind of creates that energy of consciousness. So we can never, in a Buddhist point of view, think of the world as being, you know, it's just these states of just objective places to go to, nor can we think of them as being purely subjective. They are a relationship between those two things. Now, if you were to ask from a traditional Buddhist point of view, you know, you say, where is hell? And they say, it's down there, right? It's very straightforward, yeah? And, you know, the descriptions of hell in the suttas, it describes hell as being like a kind of a place, a fiery place full of molten metal. And it actually does sound quite a lot like the center of the earth, you have to kind of admit, right? And there's also like cold hells, which are supposed to be in the middle of intergalactic space, you know, and there's that kind of sounds pretty hellish as well. I don't know, but then, you know, where does heaven exist, right? On the side slopes of Mount Meru. And that seems a bit less persuasive as a location for hell since, well, Mount Meru doesn't exist for a start. But this is something which I think we don't get much information or idea really from the suttas. And I think it's very much an open question. And something, you know, we can say from a Buddhist point of view that you know, it's clear that the Buddha did teach that these things were real in some kind of sense, but it's not easy to say how that sense relates to our current sort of physical understanding of how the world is. And I think that's something which is an open question. Cecilia. 1 second.
I'm curious why the animal realm is lower than the ghost realm.
Yeah, it's quite striking, isn't it? Yeah. Obviously, it seems to be that the suffering in the animal realm on the whole is worse than the suffering in the ghost realm. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe ghosts are okay. I don't know. Depends on the kind. I mean, I guess there's a lot of variation. Depends on the kind of animal and the kind of ghost, I guess. But yeah, it is quite a striking feature.
This is not just this sutta, as you see. This is across the board in the suttas, that the animal realm is always considered lower than the ghost realm. So this, I think, is a very common misunderstanding that the ghost realm somehow is below the animal realm. I think most people seem to believe that. But actually, the suttas is the other way around.
I think the ghosts are, you know, ghosts are conceived as being kind of intelligent and, you know.
Suffering.
Yeah, they're suffering. They're in a state of deprivation, but they're still, you know, they have a...
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the interesting things about this sutta, again, as I also mentioned before, one of the other suttas, is that in each one of these cases, the Buddha talks about a specific path, right? You're on the path to reappearing in that realm. In other words, there's a specific karma that leads to that particular realm. You don't have this either black or white. You have certain mind states which lead to these things. And the commentaries, they explain this. I think this is probably quite reasonably well taken on part of the commentaries. At the hell realms, is mostly you arrive there mostly because of anger and hatred, which kind of makes sense. If you're angry and hatred, you have a very bad mind state. And the animal realm is very much based on delusion, which again makes good sense. Animals have very limited abilities to perceive the world, of course. And the ghost realm, they say, this is perhaps a bit more questionable, but the ghost realm, they say, is more greed-based. And you can see why that, you know, what that hierarchy kind of fits quite well with the idea of the severity of the karma that you experience.
A bit loud, this. I'm just wondering about ghosts. They seem to have some kind of close relationship to human beings. Like, you never hear about ghosts in the form of animals, do you? Like, in the ghost world, are they all human-like, a direct relationship to the human? They're one step below the human, and therefore, you hear what I'm saying there? And also a question about heavenly beings. They're talking about extra dimensions these days. Would maybe heavenly beings, could they inhabit other dimensions other than the ones that we're familiar with?
Well, I mean, it's a kind of convenient word to use, but it's basically one of these words that's a bit meaningless. I mean, if you're talking about, actual dimensions as in physics and string theory and so on, then they have quite a clearly, precisely defined meaning within that context, which I think is different from any meaning that we might give to them in natural language. So I'm a bit kind of cautious about invoking sort of scientific-sounding lingo unless we sort of have a clearly defined reason for doing it. Yeah. I'd rather just say, well, we don't really know what it is. Yeah. Rather than pretending we've solved some problem by using a scientific word. Sorry. We had another question here. Sorry. One second.
Yeah, quick one. So Bhante, we don't find the description of ghosts as being animals or shadows of animals. Usually they are shadows of people, right? They're like distorted.
Yes, what the gentleman just said, yeah. So I think that's pretty much right, isn't it? Do we have ghosts? Can animals be ghosts? I don't know. Anyone ever seen any ghost animals? Uh-huh. Okay. The ghost dog who returned a ring to a lady. So there you go. Okay. Yep. So there you go. Yeah.
Bhante, in the Tirukkuda Sutta, it's more like people who cannot grow the earth, people who cannot grow their own food.
Right.
And prepare their own clothes, so it's more shade of humans than anything.
That's right. That tends to be how they're talked about most of the time. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Yep. Sorry. Yes.
I tried to read the Preta stories, a couple of them, because I wanted to know what was it about. And
yeah.
Ajahn Brahm showed me where they were in the library, because they weren't on Sutta Central.
Hmm.
Not translated, I don't think. Anyway, I had a go.
My apologies, yeah.
That's all right. No, you know, I had a go, and I found myself going, whoa, you know, because, like, some of the descriptions were just really horrible sorts of things that were going on. But there was a repeated theme in them, which is basically that these unfortunate beings, these ghosts, you know, they needed somebody to deliver them from the horrendous action they'd done in their life.
Right.
To get out of that realm. So, I mean, I'm just sitting here thinking, okay, animal, ghost, why is it high? Well, I think maybe, I wonder if it's because you get the opportunity as a ghost to be delivered from, you know, the condition more so than an animal would be.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, that might be part of it, but this sutta, if you look at it, it explicitly says that the suffering is greater in the animal realm. It talks about the suffering. One is kind of lying in the shade of the tree, another one is being immersed in a cesspit. You know, and one is about experiencing, I think, much painful feeling, and the one about experiencing very painful feeling. There is actually a difference there in the, also the tones of experience as well, I think, yeah, between the two, yeah.
Nicholas. One sec.
Even in the human world, you see variations where, you know, some people are living as if they're in some sort of lower realm. Deprivation and other people living like Davis.
Yeah. Of course, yeah.
Variation.
Mm.
Maybe it's the same in the other realms as well.
Of course there is.
Yeah.
Even more so, I think, yeah.
And these, yeah. You know, the realms are only, you know, the realms are only conventions and categories. I mean, you could say, you know, there's different classes of people, upper class and middle class and working class or something like that. But, I mean, actually the reality is that, you know, it's much more complex than that. Yeah. So these are only just very rough generalizations. Yeah.
But I think also the thing you said that some people live like devas, some people live like animals or ghosts or whatever. But I think the reality is that if you are a human, you actually are either much worse off than the devas, regardless of where you're at, or much better off than the ghosts, regardless of where you're at. So in a sense, you have a certain bandwidth, which means the human bandwidth. You can be so happy and you can be so much suffering, but you can't really go beyond that. And by adding these other realms, it's like you're expanding the bandwidth of happiness and suffering and allowing that a much, much greater scope for maturing in terms of karma, in terms of suffering and happiness. So you're maybe a little bit deva-like as a human, but you're much more deva-like as a deva, right? That is the... Yeah.
Just on that animal realm and the ghost realms, what we have learned is, I think we learned just at the discussion as well when you mentioned that ghosts are the only people, so beings in the ghost realms are the only ones who is capable of receiving merits. So therefore they have the better option of getting a better rebirth, and the animal beings in the animal realms don't have that luxury. So therefore naturally Buddha has classified them under at a lower level. So the animals, as we have learned according to the sutras, is that we have learned from you, is that they have to do their own little good karma to get out from that animal realm. But as opposed to that, the ghost can piggy bank on others' merits. So to finding a better word, they can escape from that the suffering level by receiving the merits from others.
They can, if they are so lucky, if they have a good Buddhist as a family member, then they can maybe escape. But the vast majority don't have that, you know. So they are stuck, but they're looking for the relatives, please do something on my account. And the relatives just ignore them completely. They're dead, they're past. So that's why it is so nice to do something, right? You know that there are people there who may be able to receive some benefit from you. So we do that as Buddhists. And it's a wonderful thing to be able to do. And hopefully it has some kind of effect. So, yeah.
One of the Thai monks who went to visit America, he's a monk who has a reputation of being able to see these kind of different realms. And when he came back from America, they asked him about what it was like, and he said, it's full of hungry ghosts. Yeah, he said people so attached to their homes and their possessions that they're all hanging around there. Yeah. Tim.
Yeah, just on that same topic, I haven't had personal experience of the ghost realm or anyone in the ghost realm, so I can't say personally if they're happy with the work that I've given to them or met or anything. But a dog, on the other hand, shows a great amount of affection, loyalty, goodwill, intelligence, guide dogs, all those kinds of things. Dolphins can find, and other mammals can find, you know, explosive devices and stuff to help human beings. So I'm thinking they're building a huge amount of good karma. But I'm also pretty fundamentally aware that most people kind of disregard animals and just rip down Indonesian rainforest and stuff like that. So I'm wondering if there's a bit of a pattern in how we're deciphering the texts as to how we think about animals now as well. What's your thoughts on that?
I'm not sure. Can you be more explicit?
Well, so the discussion is that animals are below ghosts because ghosts can get influence from family members and other such things. But from my experience, animals are very susceptible to gaining good merit and actually doing good merit, so therefore should probably be higher than ghosts because they're actually present beings, they're actually doing stuff. And because our modern life pretty much disregards animals quite a lot, like from eating them to the way we farm them to destroying their homes, I'm wondering if that...
But this, don't confuse the two things. I mean, to say that you're reborn in that realm which is suffering, it doesn't mean that it justifies treating you like crap, right? Mm. I mean, you know, you can argue that being generous means you're more likely to be reborn in a wealthy place. That doesn't mean you can treat the poor like rubbish, okay?
Uh-huh.
On the contrary, it means you have more compassion for them.
Uh-huh.
You know, so beings who are deprived and who are in a state of suffering are the beings who most need compassion and most need help.
Mm.
So, you know, don't confuse these two things, right? They're quite separate kinds of ideas, right? So what we're talking here is what are the causes that tend to lead to these different kinds of rebirths, right? Another entirely different question is what is our appropriate response and how should we treat those people? And so always treating, you know, all beings, wherever they are, out of compassion is the most important thing. But also, I mean, just, you know, a small point, you know, we did raise this point earlier, but, you know, I think it's a bit misleading to use those kinds of examples because, you know, a guide dog or a trained dolphin or something is like the peak 0.001% of animals in terms of their intelligence and so on. And the vast majority of animals are, in fact, ants and plankton and things like that who don't display those kind of characteristics. So, you know, the whole realm as a whole, you know, how many earthworms are there? How many lice are there? So, the, you know, the vast majority of animals live lives that are fairly limited in terms of their cognitive and ethical capacities. I think we can be pretty confident of that. It's not to say that obviously there are some animals that do have, you know, more opportunity, but that's a fairly small proportion of them. Yeah. You know, definitely in terms of what our responsibility is, absolutely our responsibility is to help.
Okay. Yeah, I'm also pretty aware that, like, we can't communicate. Not many people can communicate with a worm or a gnat or an ant, but we can see they're doing socially really adaptable things. You know, octopuses can solve massive problems.
Octopuses are different. They're pretty smart.
Sure,
right?
But so can ants. So ants can actually also solve major problems and work out where to get food from and where water is.
Right, using a collective intelligence, yeah?
Yeah, chemicals and all sorts of stuff. They're a form of communication, but I just feel like we're underwriting the ability for an animal's consciousness, and that shows up in this kind of stuff and this discussion.
Maybe it's just that the ghosts are better than you think.
Maybe
you're underestimating the ghosts.
So in the scriptures, is there much word about how beneficial an animal is, or a tree, or a plant, as opposed to a ghost? How much more?
I don't insist too much on this whole kind of thing. You know, I mean, like we said, these are just very broad generalizations. You know, so you know, don't make too much of it that it's meant to be. We're just talking about, you know, different kinds of acts that you can do. And, the basic idea is that if you do something good, you end up in a good state. You do something bad, you end up in a bad state. That's the main point. You know, these different realms, they're all very variable. And if you look in details at all of the stories, there's so much complexity and so many different variations and things. They're just generalizations. Yeah. Don't worry about it too much. Yeah. But certainly your point is well taken in the sense that, you know, what we can do for animals is, you know, we can do more for them than we can for any other realm. And currently, you know, I think what we do is very harmful to animals, so definitely we should change the way that we behave. Absolutely. You know, this is very important. Yes.
Yes, following this discussion, in the same that there is a great variety of animals on Earth and in the universe, could we say that there is also a great variety of ghosts, of devas, as well as human beings, as we know? So basically, all these beings everywhere in all these realms are all different.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And like I said, they're just generalizations. I mean, when you push any kind of definition far enough, you know, what does it mean? I mean, you know, they mentioned before about the Peta stories. I mean, you get these stories, whether they're true or not, but they illustrate the flexibility of it. I mean, you get these stories of somebody who goes to the monastery and offers dana during the daytime and then goes to the brothel and gets drunk in the nighttime, right? So they get reborn as a deva in the daytime and a Peta at the nighttime, right? You know, I mean, these realms are not meant to be fixed categories. You know, they're just meant to illustrate the different kinds of states that your consciousness can get born in. Yeah, yeah.
There's a sutta, and I can't remember where I read it, but there's a deva that comes to the Buddha, and is begging to get out of the deva realm because of the pleasantness of the deva realm, and the Buddha trains the deva to go above those sort of dualities. Too nice. It was too.
It's like living in Perth
beautiful.
Or something.
Yeah. He just. I don't know if you know the sutta I'm talking about. I read it somewhere.
I am not sure the exact one. Can you remember the exact one?
I cannot.
I cannot recall such a sutta.
I can't find it. But yeah, so the Buddha trains the deva to
transcend, yeah.
Transcend the deva realm. So, I mean, it sounds all wonderful to be reborn in the deva realm, but, you know,
there is one
not liberation, is it?
Yeah. There is one sutta which is a little bit like that. And that is a sutta in, that's the, I think, the Digha Nikaya, Sakkapanya Sutta. And that is, as a monk, sort of looked after by a laywoman, you know, while they're human beings, of course, and she looks after all the needs and supports them, all these kind of things. And then they get reborn in the same realm, I think, the, you know, kind of lower heavenly realm. And then this laywoman goes up to them and says, "You guys, I supported you for your spiritual practice, and you get reborn in the same realm as me. What's going on there?" And then two of those, once they get kind of told off by this ex-supporter, it says they give rise to mindfulness, which means they recollect the teachings. And as soon as they do that, they get reborn in the higher realm. That is the only one I can remember, which is a little bit like that.
So that, the good lesson from that is lay people sometimes ask whether it's right to criticize monks, and the answer is yes, you can criticize monks, and sometimes you can be very helpful. Yeah.
Yeah. There's another point here, but before we move on, which I think is quite nice, and that is this idea of this man who is scorched, exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched, and thirsty. So as you said, he might be Australian, but it might also just be, this I take to be the person who is wandering around in samsara, right? This is the person who is going around and around. He doesn't find any final refuge from the suffering of samsara. He's kind of burnt again and again and again. He's trying to find a place of refuge. And then sometimes he gets reborn in the ghost realm, and he doesn't really find any refuge. Sometimes he gets reborn in the animal realm, and he gets even worse things. And so this seems to be a simile for that eye. I would guess. Okay.
Okay, so, sorry, we have another question there? Yeah, please.
Is this question on, like, the human realms, are they actually defined by being human? And what I mean is, if the universe is so large and time sort of goes on for a while, at the moment we're the only intelligent species on this planet, but if there are other species that aren't actually human that are of our intelligence level, would they also be a part of the human realm?
Sure, yeah. You know, you have multiple world systems, and always fundamental part of Buddhist cosmology is the belief that there are, you know, multiple world systems. Even in the Buddha's first sermon, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta talks about the Dasasahasi Loka Dhatu, the 10,000-fold world system, which is obviously like a galaxy or something like that. And in some places it describes that in quite some detail, and each world system has its own sun and its own planets and so on, and their own, you know, people and animals in different realms and so on and so forth. So yes, there's even you know, it seems, I mean, from our own history on planet Earth, that there's a very kind of narrow window, you know, I mean, for humans are only here for a very tiny proportion of the life of the planet. But of course, there are so many other planets throughout the galaxy, and even if the chances of intelligent life appearing are very small, then still it seems almost inevitable that there is some intelligent life in other places. So one of the questions then is, can you get reborn in those other realms, right? So what happens, for example, what happens if you make sort of good sort of human rebirth karma, right? But then humans kind of stuff it up, right? And let's say we all nuke ourselves, or we sort of let the climate run away and everyone dies. And so you die and you've got good karma to get reborn in the human realm, but there's no human realm here to get reborn into. So maybe you might go to another planet and get reborn there, especially if you're like a science fiction fan or something like that. And, you know, if you're a Star Trek fan, you probably go get reborn in different places. And, you know, it's quite an interesting thing to contemplate, you know, from a Buddhist point of view. I did give a talk here about Buddhism and aliens some time ago, last year, and it was quite interesting because I gave the talk here not really thinking too much about it. I just was going to give a fun talk, but then when I went to Malaysia and Singapore, they kept on asking me to give talks about Buddhism and aliens. So that was actually... I think everyone got bored of everyone talking about mindfulness and stuff, so they wanted to hear about aliens instead, so... So, yeah, but, you know, it, I think it, you know, it, it is an important topic because it reminds us that from the Buddhist point of view, you know, we live in this vast space. You know, the vastness of space and time has always been a part of Buddhism. The multiplicity of these world systems and states of rebirth and so on has always been a part of it. The idea that, you know, you can have beings who exist in these vast abysses of interstellar space. You know, we find this in the suttas, right? The idea that you can have beings reborn in these multiple world systems and so on. All of this we find in the suttas. So I personally think that it's, you know, it's likely that there are beings who live on other planets. They haven't come to visit us yet, but... you know, it may be possible that we find some kind of evidence for them, or we can go and discover them, or something like that. And I think that if we do find them, you know, they may have kind of green skin and six arms and noses growing out of the top of their heads, or something like that. But they will certainly suffer. And I, my guess is that they'll probably suffer from, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion.
It's just that they can suffer, I guess. Since there's nothing really special about humans as in us humans,
yeah.
At the same time, because they can suffer, they can also probably obtain nirvana as well if they have their own Buddha.
I would think so, yeah. You know, they're like, they're thinking, oh, my skin is not green enough. Oh, I wish my skin was greener. And
In at least one of the suttas, the earthbound devas are included in the human realm.
Mm.
Where do they fit in to this perspective? Is it just that they're such a minority or something that they don't really get included?
Oh, like I said, it's just the flexible boundaries. It's just generalizations, yeah. So we don't have to think in terms of black and white. Actually, there's dozens of suttas that talk about all different kinds of devas that are not included in the mainstream selection. You know, you have this basic cosmology. It's in something like the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, where it has like the Chaturmaharajika devas and the Yama devas and Tusita and Tavatimsa and so on. But then there's stacks of others, dozens of others mentioned in different kind of realms and so on. You look in the Mahasamaya Sutta and Atanatiya Sutta and all these different places. So actually, you know, it's just that the world is very, very varied. And the whole point of it is not that it's not to classify them. The point is to understand that each of those states of rebirth is produced by consciousness. Right? They're all what the Buddha called vijñānatthiti, stations of consciousness. So they're all made by karma. They're all made by our minds, by our choices. And so, you know, if you look at your mind and you look at all the different states that your mind has been in through your whole life, right? And all the different kind of, each one of those states, you know, all those choices that you've made, all those different karmas, you know, they can lead to different states of rebirth. And so that's why there's so many, because the mind is so varied.
I'm just wondering why they're not sort of considered to be the apex of the human realm in terms of, you know, worldling beings, but rather in the example, it's like a human being.
Sorry, I don't understand the question.
Well, you know, like, if you think that the earthbound devas are in a more refined state than ordinary human beings, I'm wondering why... In the simile of the wandering person, they're not used as the example, as kind of like the most refined kind of pleasure of the human realm.
Yeah, I don't know.
They're probably devas, right? They're called earthbound devas, which are part of the deva realm, not the human realm. Okay.
Oh, I don't want to go too far with it because it's not that important, but I know in one sutta it's included as part of the human realm.
Okay, maybe we'll do some meditation and for 5 minutes. Okay, so let's move along to the last session of the day. And we've got a few more sutta passages to have a look at. This was the simile of the blind turtle. Venerable.
Okay, so this is from Majjhima Nikaya 129, the Bala Pandita Sutta, the fool and the wise person. And this is a very famous simile, and I think it's nice just to have a quick look at it, because it is quoted a lot, and I think it is very often misquoted. It's good to have a quick look and see what this simile says. It's basically about the chance of being reborn as a human being in a certain way. Let's have a quick look at it. Suppose a man threw into the sea a yoke with one hole in it, and the east wind carried it to the west wind carried it to the east, the north wind carried it to the south, and the south wind carried it to the north. Suppose there were a blind turtle that came up once at the end of each century. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Would that blind turtle put his neck into that yoke with one hole in it? Right? He might, Venerable Sir, sometime or other at the end of a long period. Because the blind turtle will sooner put his neck into that yoke with a single hole in it than a fool once gone to perdition, this means like a lower state of rebirth, would take to regain a human state, I say. Why is that? Because there's no practicing of the Dhamma there, no practicing of what is righteous, no doing of what is wholesome, no performance of merit. Their mutual devouring prevails, and the slaughter of the weak. So this is a very often quoted sutta, and the quote, of course, is people tend to read this as, well, this is the chance of being reborn as a human, right? The chance is the same as a blind turtle sticking its head through a yoke, drifting randomly on the ocean. That's a pretty dismal kind of dismal way of understanding this, isn't it? But the point here, and the reason I want to look at this, is to, first of all, there was a scholar quite recently who made this particular argument in one of his scholarly papers, and he was arguing he had recently given up on Buddhism and become a Catholic again. He was originally Catholic, had gone back to Catholicism, and the reason he said was that there is no hope in Buddhism, because once the chances of being reborn as a human are so slight, that it's pointless to practice Buddhism because you're going to go down to a bad rebirth anyway. And he was quoting basically this kind of sutta, that there is no choice, there's no hope for us. But you have to read the sutta in the right way. And the first thing that you will see when you read this is that this concerns the fool, right? And the fool is then defined in the same sutta as a person who habitually breaks the five precepts, right? That's the fool. So somebody who habitually practices in the wrong way. And of course, if you do that, you build up a vast store of bad karma, and you probably have built up very little good karma at the same time. So there's nothing to support you to have a high rebirth. And of course, if you have no support for high rebirth, it's going to be very hard, right? It's going to be very difficult to get back to the human state again. This is the second thing. But the other point here, which is equally important for this particular simile, is that it concerns the situation where you are already reborn in a bad state. It's not about the general ability to be reborn as a human being. It is what happens when you are already kind of gone to hell or gone to an animal realm or something like that. What then is your ability to come back to the human realm again? That is when the problem arises. So this is, I think, these are very important qualifiers. And once you understand that, you realize that a lot of this idea that is very hard to regain or to be reborn in general as a human being, a lot of that comes from things which are not part of the early Buddhist text. This is a course on early Buddhism. Later Buddhism, perhaps, this is what they teach, but not in the early Buddhist teachings. So I think this is a very important qualifier right there. Okay, so that's just that simile here. Everybody happy with that? Yeah? Yes, sir.
I think, I used to think that this gave no hope at all for animals or whatever, but actually in a way there is a hope for the animals, because it does say you're not reborn as a human being because there's no chance of practicing what is righteous.
Yeah.
So perhaps that could imply that if an animal does get the chance to practice what's righteous, like a guide dog or whatever,
yeah,
then they might have a bit more hope.
Yeah. To be kind to the animals, in other words. Yeah. They might actually do the right thing. Yeah. Good then.
Just a question which might be not directly linked to, but as it comes up as performance of merit, could you say maybe something about relationship between good karma, good action, wholesome deed, and merit, punya, how the relationship is of then?
Yeah.
And then the other thing is like maybe some word on or advice on kind of like what could be the two extreme is like accumulating merit, doing a lot of performance, good karma, but kind of merit.
Yeah.
And almost like for coming from an environment recently, it's like a lot of times people are really even saying, I'm doing this because of merit.
Mm.
So it's a bit the other extreme. And then the other extreme is more like doing things out of a natural goodness, but without even reflecting on it that it's a good deed. And as I understand from earlier this afternoon, if one is not really consciously doing something good, it might not have the same effect. So, yeah, so these are the two questions I have. Yeah.
Okay, well, the first one, I think basically the idea of merit, which is punya in Pali, and the idea of good acts, karma, it basically is two sides of the same thing. They are actually the same thing, really. And if you look at the basis of merit as it is defined in certain suttas, it covers generosity, it covers morality, and it also covers meditation. And that is very similar to the way karma works, as long as you're purifying yourself, doing the right thing. But punya and karma, I take to be virtually synonymous in the suttas. I don't think you can really distinguish that. But of course, the way it is often used in kind of modern, where people talk about it, punya often means generosity, right? You give stuff, and by giving things, you make good punya, and you get something in return in the future life. So that is right. The second half of the question is about basically how we should give. Really, that's really what that comes down to. We've actually discussed that in our group earlier today. And of course, the idea of giving can be done in many different ways. And of course, in the suttas, you see the hierarchies of how you should actually be, what kind of mind state you should have when you give. And of course, the idea of being greedy, I want a good rebirth, is not beneficial. If you want to maximize or you want to kind of make the highest possible karma, the brightest possible karma, you want to avoid that. Any kind of greed is going to kind of pull down the brightness of that karma. So really, the best way to give is just to give because it feels good, right? You give because you're happy when you give. You're happy afterwards. It says in the suttas that the highest giving is where the giving is considered just as a requisite for the mind, the citta parikara. Parikara is a requisite for the mind. In other words, it is something that you're adding to the mind to aid you on the path to awakening, right? It's a requisite for awakening. Or is it called a citta alankara? Alankara basically means a jewel, or jewelry rather. So it's like a jewelry for the mind. You're beautifying your mind. And that is what this is for. And this is the highest kind of giving, when you give in that way. So you kind of reduce the defilements to the maximum, and you have a pure intention as possible. So yes, it is important how we give, but often it is also important not to set the bar too high. Because if you start off saying, I only want to give when I kind of, have a sense of this is going to be a requisite for a mind, you may never end up giving at all because you're never pure enough. So you start off giving, for the wrong reasons, and gradually you purify yourself and you're giving more pure reasons down the path. Okay.
So we might move on to the next passage here. We've just got a few short passages to just cover before we finish the class, and these are things which we thought were quite important to read. This is just a nice passage. This one doesn't, I think, really tell us anything new. Oh, you read it, please. Your favorite passage. Go.
Okay. this is one of my favorite passages in the suttas. This is a great one. Is that where it started off? Or did it just take down a bit?
I took it down a bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Yeah. So this is stated from the same sutta, the Majjhima 129, the wise and the fool, or the fool and the wise man. And now what we're talking about now is basically the karma in this life, right? What is the result of good actions in this very life? And this is what this is about. I really like this particular passage. So again, when a wise man is on his chair or on his bed or resting on the ground, then the good actions that he did in the past, his good bodily, verbal and mental conduct, they cover him overspread him and envelop him, just as the shadow of a great mountain peak in the evening covers, overspreads, and envelops the earth. So too, when a wise man is on his chair or on his bed or resting on the ground, and the good actions that he did in the past, his or her good bodily, verbal, and mental conduct cover him or her, overspread him, and envelop him. There, the wise man thinks thus, I have not done what is evil. I have not done what is cruel. I have not done what is wicked. I have done what is good. I have done what is wholesome. I have made myself a shelter from anguish. When I pass away, I shall go to the destination of those who have not done what is evil, who have made themselves a shelter from anguish. He does not sorrow, grieve, and lament. He does not weep, beating his breast, and become distraught. This is the third kind of pleasure and joy that a wise man feels here and now. So this is like, I really like this idea, because it's like you have done so much good karma, right? That all you have to do is just sit down on your chair, and you kind of close your eyes, and you allow yourself to be completely overspread and enveloped and covered in all your goodness, right? Just like the shadow of the great mountain. And you can't avoid feeling a sense of happiness because of all the good actions you have done. And so this is kind of the ideal of virtue, of living a truly virtuous life, is that you cannot actually avoid that sense of happiness, sense of contentment that comes from that life. And of course, that then becomes the basis for meditation practice, right? Meditation practice is always founded on virtue. It is the first factor in what they call a transcendental liberation. Once that virtue is very powerful at its base, the rest happens just by itself. And then all you can do is just sit back, and meditation practice tends to happen as a consequence. So that is the happiness in that karmic consequences in this very life of doing good actions. So. Okay.
Okay. Long Judy, do we have time to do this?
Sure.
You sure?
Yeah, let me pass the 20 minutes.
All right, so Majjhima Nikaya number 57, we actually had a question about this earlier. This is about the dog duty ascetic. Here, Punna, so this is the Buddha in conversation with a wanderer who has the kind of inclination to do these kinds of things. Someone develops the dog duty. So just to clarify, dog duty doesn't mean doing duties to dogs, right? It doesn't mean helping out dogs or anything like that. It means living exactly like a dog, okay? So you walk around on all fours and you go naked and you pee here and there and you eat your food from the floor and all of these kinds of things. So you got to do this duty as a dog because you believe that you're going to burn up your dog karma by doing that. And that therefore you're not going to get reborn as a dog next time. So here, Punna, somebody develops a dog duty fully and uninterruptedly, the dog habit, the dog mind, the dog behavior. Having done so on the dissolution of the body, after death he reappears in the company of dogs. But if he has such a view as this, by this virtue or observance or asceticism or holy life, I shall become a great god or some lesser god. That is a wrong view in his case. Now there are two destinations for one with wrong view, I say, hell or the animal realm. So Punna, if his dog duty succeeds, it will lead him to the company of dogs. If it fails, it will lead him to hell. So there you go, the message being, don't live like a dog. Just in case you were thinking of doing that. I mean, we laugh, but there was a case I read about in the paper some years ago. It was a Russian performance artist who was doing an installation in the New York Museum of Modern Art where he was actually doing exactly that and living like a dog. And he actually came through, the newspaper article talked about how he came through the customs at New York Airport, and as soon as he went through the customs, he immediately took off all his clothes, got down on the ground and started sniffing people and barking. And then they put a leash on him and they took him to the museum, and he sort of curled up beside a dish and they'd throw some food in the dish and he'd just do his business there and sleep there and so on. And that was his art installation, right? I don't know. Maybe it was art. I don't know. Anyway, moving along. Punna. So there are, and this is actually the more important, doctrinally the more important part of it, which is quite very significant and needs to be borne in mind all the time. There are four kinds of action proclaimed by me after realizing them for myself with direct knowledge. So first of all, notice the Buddha's talking about karma as so often in the suttas as being something that he's known and seen for himself, not as being something which he's inherited from the culture around him. What for? There is dark action with dark result, bright action with bright result, dark and bright action with dark and bright result. There is action that is neither dark nor bright with neither dark nor bright result, action that leads to the destruction of action. Okay, so karma that leads to the ending of karma. So there's four kinds of karma. Now this use of a fourfold logical structure is very, very characteristic of both Buddhism, but also of the Indian religions and philosophies generally. We find this kind of thing all the way through. As opposed to Western philosophy, and following Aristotle, there was always a tendency to use binary logical structures, right? So we're very used to that. It's either or, right? And that's sort of hardwired into all of our computers these days. They're all ones and zeros, right? So if it was Indians who'd developed the first computers, right, you can imagine that. It would be like a one, a zero, maybe it's on, maybe it's off. And it would be neither on nor off, right? And in fact, you know, this is where in Western science, you know, you even reach the limits of this binary thinking, of course, with quantum theory, right? Because quantum theory, of course, is all based on probability. And, of course, they're actually trying to build quantum computers, right? And that's precisely what they do. They have on-off, and they have all this, well, yeah, maybe it's on, maybe it's off, right? And that's actually is a much more powerful system. It's a much more powerful way of looking at things. And so often, when we try to think about ethical and moral questions, we always want to reduce it to it's either right or wrong, right? You want to be able to say, is this the right thing to do? I want to do this, I'm not sure, you know, somebody was asking this question in one of the discussions. You know, they know someone who's in the north of Queensland and have a problem with cane toads, right? So the cane toads are really destructive. So what do you do? Do you squash all the cane toads, right? Do you kill them, or what do you do? And so the most important thing from a Buddhist point of view is to acknowledge that there's actually black and white involved, right? And to want to protect the environment is a good thing, but to want to kill a creature is a bad thing. And so you have to balance that. And at the end of the day, sometimes we have to make those kinds of decisions, right? And you can't reduce it. You can't say it's good or it's bad. You can just say it has these different aspects, and you have to make a call. That's how it is, and you have to accept the results of it. So what's dark action with dark result? Somebody who generates an afflictive bodily formation. Crikey, this is not really English. It's English, Jim, but not as we know it. Okay. He's someone who makes a bad choice by way of body, speech, and mind, okay, or does a bad act by way of body, speech, and mind. So having done bad karma by body, speech, and mind, he reappears in an afflictive world. When he reappears in an afflictive world, he has afflictive feelings and so on. Similarly with bright action with bright result, you do something good and you get reborn in a good realm, and you do with dark and... Okay, jhana realm, okay. Bright action is like really bright, yeah. So dark and bright action with dark and bright result, it's kind of you're doing a bit of both, a bit of one, a bit of the other, and then you get reborn in a world where you experience both pleasure and pain, like the human realm, some gods and some beings in the lower realms. Thus, a being's reappearance is due to a being. One reappears through the actions one has performed. Thus, one is the heir to one's actions. I always remember that there's a wonderful line in the Mahavamsa, the great Sri Lankan chronicle of history. And after one of the most famous kings there was King Mahasena, who lived, I think, around 3rd century or 4th century or something. And when he died, the last line in that, it says, and so the king, after having done much good and much evil, fared on according to his karma. And I always say, what a wonderful summary of someone's life that is, you know, and especially the life of someone who's in a king or a politician. I mean, that's, we want to reduce it. Oh, he was a good king, or he was a bad king, or he was a good ruler or a bad ruler. But so often it's not like that. Actually, he did lots of good things, and also he did lots of bad things, and that's his karma. So this is the world that we live in. You know? These choices are before us. And, of course, this is one of the reasons why we the important thing of the karma, which is neither dark nor bright, with neither the dark nor bright result. As long as you're getting reborn, there are going to be cases where you're going to have to make choices that just are not good choices. And you're going to suffer because of that. So action which is neither dark nor bright is the intention for abandoning the kind of action that is dark with dark result, and the intention to abandon the kind of action that's bright with bright result, and the intention to abandon the kind of action that is dark and bright with dark and bright result. This is called action that's neither dark nor bright. Okay? So this is the fourth one, and of course this is the practicing of the Eightfold Path, right? What we're doing by developing the path, practicing Dhamma, leading to the ending of all karma, right? And this is the most important kind of karma. So you realize that even good karma is limited. Even good karma, you know, you maybe experience pleasant feelings and have a lovely time for a while, but it's limited, it's conditioned, it will end. And so if you really want to be free of suffering, and both that affliction that you cause for yourself and the affliction that you cause for others as well, then the only solution is the practice that leads to the ending of karma. Yes?
Okay. I just want to bring up one point here, and this is the point about the actions that are both dark and bright. And I think, if I may, I will disagree with you a little bit on this one, because you said that it means that you make both dark you do dark actions and you do bright actions. Yeah. But actually, it doesn't actually say that. It says that you do actions that are both dark and bright.
Uh-huh.
So the action itself is both dark and bright.
Right. Yeah.
Each action has an aspect of both sides in a sense.
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
And I think this is a very important point here, because the dark actions are defined as the actions that take you to a hell realms. They're really, really dark. And the bright actions are the ones that take you to the jhana realms. So the actions completely, you know, beyond the five hindrances, essentially. Now, in between that, there are actions which are, this is how I read this, both dark and bright. In other words, they are basically grey. They're a mixture of dark and bright. They're grey. And because of that, you read results that are dark, both dark and bright. And that doesn't mean that you reach a little bit of jhanas as a result, a little bit of hell realm as a result. It means you reap feelings that are somewhere in between those two. And this is where you get this idea that karma, essentially, as I read this sutta, is therefore something which is, most of the time, it is about grayness, a certain degree of grayness, perhaps quite light gray when you do something very beautiful and very, very nice, sometimes slightly dark gray if you do something which isn't very nice, and a lot of the time just basically gray, somewhere in between. And that grayness is that then which leads to rebirth again in the human realm later on. Or, as it says here, also to some other realms, like some of the lower realms or some of the lower heavenly realms. All of these have that mixture of dark and bright. And this is actually quite an important distinction, because one of the things that you find in later Buddhism, I'm talking about the Abhidhamma and the commentaries. Of course, the purpose of the Abhidhamma is to kind of complete the Buddhist system, to fill in all the gaps, right? To analyze everything and then to systematize it in a new way. That is really the purpose of the Abhidhamma. But by doing that, sometimes things get lost in translation, right? You try to translate a system which really is pragmatic, which is about liberation from suffering, translate that into a system which is philosophical, which is a description of reality. Of course, you are moving, you're changing the goalposts. And by changing the goalposts, things often get lost in translation. And what we're seeing here, this particular type of action, which here is called dark and bright, if you move to the Abhidhamma, this is my understanding anyway, I can't really remember when and where I read this, but this is my memory of this, they then take these dark and bright actions, divide it up and saying, well, actually, this is, you know, you do a little bit dark, then you do a bit of bright, a little bit of bright, but it happens so quickly that it seems like the action is both dark and bright, right? So essentially what they're saying is that, well, you do jhana karma, then you do hell karma, jhana karma, hell karma, very quickly one after the other. And then that is how you get this kind of dark, bright action. But if we, you know, if you look at your, how we work as human beings, it's not as if the mind changes back and forth between extremely bright action and then very dark action. That is just not natural. It's not how the world works. If you look at your own mind, you know that it tends to often be somewhere in between, right? It's kind of grayish. Okay, you have maybe a good intention, but there's a little bit of greed there, despite the good intention. Or you have a bad intention, but there's some wholesome, redeeming aspect to the bad intention as well. It's a grayness that is a standard way we experience reality and we experience our own intentions. It's not either black or white, except if you have very, very deep meditation, for example. So this is, for that reason, this is quite important, and it gives you, for me, it gives a classic example where early Buddhism actually is a bit different from later Buddhism, especially the kind of Abhidhamic idea where everything can be analyzed down to the greatest detail. If you do that, you actually lose something very important in the process. And what that means is that the way we often talk about karma, we say that, you know, we say, oh, am I making good karma with this? Or am I making bad karma with this? Actually, the whole question doesn't work like that. It's not either good karma or either bad karma. It's gray karma, which is leaning towards goodness. Or it's gray karma leaning towards badness, right? Or it's just plain old gray karma. That is actually what it is. So our whole discourse, the whole way we talk about these things is influenced by later ideas. And we don't even know it, right? This is how we take these things for granted so much. And then when you go back to the suttas, you actually see, no, it is quite different. So what we should think instead of, are we making good karma or bad karma? Am I leaning towards goodness? Am I leaning towards badness? And that is where we should take our stand. As long as we're leaning towards goodness, we're heading in the right direction. This is the lesson that I take home from this kind of sutta here.
So in summary, the karma is 50 shades of grey. Huh?
That's bad karma.
Okay, bad jokes aside, we have run out of time pretty much. And so I think we'll probably have to leave the rest of the suttas and so on. So hopefully that's all there on your reading. So if you haven't read those yet, catch up on them. And we will look forward, of course, to seeing you all next time. Now, before we leave, I just want to do a couple of bits of promotion, if that's okay. And number one, here we have the verses of the senior monks. This is a translation of the Theragatana. This translation's been up on Sutta Central for a couple of months. And this translation I did together with Jess, who's around here somewhere. Where is she? Where's Jess? Oh, there she is. There's Jess at the back. So Jess and I worked on this translation of the Theragatana. And it's really good. What can I say? It's fantastic. So anyway, so this is available now on Sutta Central, and we're producing it as a book, which hopefully will be available for free distribution and so on. But what we're doing to start with is that we're going to be giving this book as a gift to people who give donations for the Sutta Central Development Fund. And I think I might have mentioned this to you last time, that we're having a fund for Sutta Central. We've employed a developer so that we can be even more awesome. And you're sitting there thinking, how is that possible? How is it possible to be more awesome? But it's true, we can be. So with Sutta Central, we've now got over 40,000 texts on there, about 35 million words. We've got what I think is the largest and best collection of early Buddhist texts that's ever been created. And our job is that we can bring those to everybody in the world. I would like it if everyone in the world can have access to the suttas. And, you know, we're all very lucky to be able to come here for this course today and to learn these teachings and listen to them and so on. But we can only do that because of the work of different translations and translators and scholars, people who've put work in for many years. And it's been ongoing for the last 150 years in English to be able to translate the suttas, explain them, bring them across and so on. And many people in different parts of the world who speak different languages, they don't have that kind of history, and we're just sort of starting to produce suttas in different languages. Recently, I've just added the suttas in Hindi, in Finnish, so now all of those wonderful people in Finland can read at least a few of the suttas in Finnish. And so many different languages that we're able to bring to people for the first time. So if you'd like to make a contribution for Sutta Central, for the development, I believe there's a donation box at the back. Is that right? Yep. Okay, so thank you for the BSWA for letting us put the donation box there. And your contributions are most valued. We are are very, very close to being able to set up an online donation. So if you want to do that, then just keep an eye on Sutta Central, and hopefully in the next couple of weeks we'll have that up for you. We've just been waiting to finalize the details of the ABN and some other technical details, but they seem to be just about ready. So your support with Sutta Central would be greatly appreciated. So for today, I believe that's all. So thank you very much to Venerable Brahmali for coming along and helping us with this presentation. Thank you to all of you for coming along and asking such good questions and keeping us on our toes, because otherwise we get bored and complacent and we think we know all the answers. So please come along and ask us hairy questions that will show how much we really learnt. And also a special thanks to the BSWA, the caretakers, and all of the IT people and volunteers and everybody at the BSWA who have made this space available and have given us so much support to allow us to put the course on. And we look very much forward to seeing you all for the next month. And for the next month, we'll be looking at the question of, is it real? Is there any actual evidence? Maybe what we've talked about so far is just fantasy. And we're going to look at the evidence for rebirth and karma in the next workshop. So that should be a lot of fun.
And thank you, Bhante, for all your...
Me?
Work, yes.
Oh, okay. What can I say? Okay. Sadhu. Okay, very good. So let us finish by paying respects to the Triple Gem.